Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, do data centers make the city even hotter? And the smart architecture of golf courses. But first, yesterday should have been Cesar Chavez Day here in Arizona. But at the 11th hour, state lawmakers voted to repeal it. Since the New York Times published an investigation uncovering allegations of sexual abuse by the late civil rights leader, Chavez's name has been erased all over the country. And both Republicans and Democrats here at the state capitol agreed Arizona should no longer celebrate him. But before it was passed, some Democrats attempted to get the holiday not just repealed, but replaced by a holiday celebrating farm workers. That was rejected by Republicans, but the effort still passed nearly unanimously, save one sole no vote in the Senate. Democratic Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez gave an impassioned speech on the Senate floor about her own family's experience as farm workers, and she voted against the repeal. And Senator Gonzalez joins me now in studio to talk more about why. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me,
Lauren. So, as I said, you were the sole no vote in the Senate against this measure. And it sounds like because you believed it should not just be repealed, but it should be replaced. Some Democrats I've heard call this kind of a slap in the face to the farm worker movement in general. Is that what it felt like to you?
Absolutely. A repeal is always erasure of what legislation has been, put in place, and so repeal, for me, it was a slap in the face because Cesar Chavez Day was more than just for him. It was for the movement.
Mm. So let's back up and talk about what you spoke about on the floor. Your parents were farm workers. You worked in the fields with them, it sounds like. Tell us about that.
Yes, absolutely. I grew up in Guadalupe, and we grew up working in the fields that are now the city of Gilbert, east of Chandler, and in the West Valley as well, that now has grown into housing developments. But that's where we used to go and work in the fields.
What are the memories like from that time for you?
Very hard work. We were a big family of 11 siblings, and my mom and dad and not a lot of work in the community. And so that was what we had to do in order to feed the fam, put food at my parents, food in on the table. And so it was leaving when it was dark in the morning and coming home when the sun was setting. And so it was long days out working hard labor in the cotton fields, onion fields, and potato fields.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your reaction to these revelations against Cesar Chavez that have come out of late. As someone who grew up doing this work, kind of grew up in this movement, how do you think we should think about this? Like, can you separate the farm workers movement, that civil rights movement that was so impactful and important, from the person who's been credited with it for generations?
Absolutely. It's, you know, the allegations that have come up are really horrendous, but we can separate both because the work that was done by the thousands of families and people that he led, to really work on, fair wages, livable, working conditions, better working conditions, and really like bathrooms for women. We didn't have bathrooms that we could go to, breaks and potable water. So it was really hard work to do this. So that's what felt like a slap in the face, that all that work that these people, farm workers and families like us really struggled, worked hard, and some people in the movement were jailed, got hurt, and even some people died, unfortunately, during this struggle.
So there was a moment on the Senate floor when you were speaking about this, when you put on your mother's work gloves. And I think a lot of people were really moved by that. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. We picked a lot of cotton, and the cotton branches have a really prickly, they scratch your hands when you're picking them. And I put them on because we all worked in the fields picking the cotton, but we could only afford one pair of gloves to protect one's hand, and that was for mom because she was the fastest and cotton picker, and so we needed her to have them.
Interesting. So let me ask you about what a farm worker's day would have meant to you. I mean, like, we heard arguments from some of the GOP senators that, you know, we don't celebrate every other profession or we already have Labor Day, things like that. What would it have meant to you?
Well, it really would have been the respect and the recognition that these farm workers that work in the fields like my family did, struggled. Are resilient because we still have farm workers today working out in the fields in these hard conditions, and elements that we recognize their contribution to our history, not only to this is Arizona's history, but also to the U.S. and that they put food on our table, for all Americans.
The bill now to repeal Cesar Chavez Day is on Governor Hobbs' desk. She says that she will sign it. I wonder, will you continue to push for a Farm Workers Day? Do you think that's something that could come to fruition? I know lawmakers kind of left the door open to that.
Yes, I will continue for that. I sent a veto letter and to ask the governor to veto it, to send it back to us so that we can not repeal it, but rename it in recognition of the struggle and the works for all farm workers in Arizona. Just like follow the suit of California, follow the suits of the cities of Phoenix and Tucson who renamed it and continue the celebration for the farm worker movement.
Where do you think that movement goes from here without Cesar Chavez's name attached to it with this kind of mark on it?
I think it goes forward because farm workers still are working every day to put to support their families, but in doing so, they are feeding and putting food on our tables every day of the year.
Okay, I'll leave it there for now. That is State Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez joining us about this. Thank you so much, Senator, for coming in. I appreciate you telling us your story here.
And thank you for having me.
The Trump administration has awarded the contract to operate the ICE facility in Surprise to a company called GardaWorld Federal Services. The firm will need to retrofit the former warehouse into a detention facility designed to hold around 1,500 people. According to Project Saltbox, whose mission is to watch procurements and purchases of the Department of Homeland Security is making due to the One Beautiful, Big Beautiful Bill Act, the GardaWorld contract runs for a year through early March of 2027. Though it could extend into 2029. The total contract is worth more than $313 million. Mike Riston is a government procurement analyst and reporter with Project Saltbox. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about what he found, and they started with who GardaWorld Federal Services is.
Yeah, GardaWorld is an international company, and they're not exactly small either. They're essentially a security firm that you'll see them in shopping malls and grocery stores. And what they provide are trained security personnel. They provide, store surveillance, building surveillance. They are a major player, both commercially and federally. They have a lot of contracts with the federal government as well. But this is their first major, what I would call, retrofit project.
Do we have a sense of why DHS decided to go with a company that really hadn't done this before for this project?
No, and it's interesting. We've actually seen this happen in Hagerstown, Maryland, which is, I think, the closest analog to the Surprise facility, both in terms of size and sort of the brought up to the retrofit contracts. So in Hagerstown, or technically it's Williamsport, Maryland, which is a suburb of Hagerstown, similar situation, a warehouse was purchased. Now it's being retrofitted. There's a temporary restraining order that's been filed by the state to stop that work. But the company that was granted that contract, KVG LLC from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, similarly does not have a background in detention work, nor do they have a background in facility conversion work. We do know that in both the Surprise case and the Hagerstown case, within the contract vehicle that controls those spaces, multiple companies were competing for the chance to do this work, but the work ultimately got awarded to GardaWorld in Surprise and KVG in Hagerstown. What we would expect to see next is hiring staff for medical services, guards. Obviously, I think that's within the wheelhouse of GardaWorld to provide, but processing staff, people that actually interact with detainees as they come into the facility and process them in, that sort of staff, I think would tend to be subcontracted.
Okay, so you mentioned subcontractors, and I wanted to ask you about that because you referenced that, for example, you know, retrofitting an existing space into something else is not really something GardaWorld does. Do they have the ability? Do we know if they have the ability to, for example, hire somebody else to come in and actually do that work and maybe they oversee it, or some of the other work that they have to do in terms of operating this facility? Could they subcontract that out, or is this work that GardaWorld is going to have to figure out how to do?
Yeah, so that's captured in the contract vehicle as something called wraparound services. And so what they were basically brought on board to do, GardaWorld, KVG, and a number of others, was actually provide logistics support to the U.S. military. What they are doing and what they can do, and we've seen this with KVG in Hagerstown, we've not yet seen it in Surprise yet, is that they are subcontracting certain elements of it. KVG is a construction firm, so I have no doubt that they would be able to do the construction element, but the healthcare piece is not within their wheelhouse. So they have contracted out with an international healthcare firm that would bring in nurses and doctors to do frontline triage care and sick call. They have subcontracted with Inovion LLC out of Austin, Texas, which is going to be providing the processing staff. We have not seen similar subcontracts yet in Surprise, so we don't know what GardaWorld can or cannot provide at this time. But we are continuing to watch that, and if those contracts do drop or those subcontracts drop, we would obviously want to record that and make sure that that information is available publicly so that people can be informed about what's happening in their neighborhood.
Is it notable in any way to you that, unlike sort of the previous model, DHS will own these buildings as opposed to contracting with a company to operate them who also owns it?
Yes, that is notable. And so this is something that we, in the course of our investigation into this network of warehouses, have talked to a number of sources, both within DHS and within the contracting world, who have all basically intimated that the reason that ICE is making such a concerted push for ownership over contracting, typically ICE would contract a detention center out to CoreCivic or Geo Group, ownership gives them the federal supremacy to essentially run that site without direct state interference. So a good example of this, in Maryland, there's a number of state laws that are being drafted and have already been drafted that would essentially ban private detention facilities from being operated. So if the site were owned by GardaWorld or CoreCivic or Geo Group, and they were running them on behalf of the United States government, state law would be able to intercede and stop them from operating in such a way, and could potentially shut them down much easier. Sort of the hierarchy of a commercial vendor having to adhere to state law and federal law applies. In the case of direct ownership by the Department of Homeland Security, supremacy doctrine essentially allows them to say, we own this site, it is a federal enclave, we are not bound by state laws, we can do pretty much whatever we want. You know, again, this is DHS's thinking, as long as it fits within the property that we own. But when their activities leave that property line and they have to connect to state utilities or state-owned roads, or essentially have to rely on some form of interagency agreement with law enforcement or medical providers, the state has direct power over that. And so what we saw in Social Circle, Georgia, just recently was the locality saying, you may own that land and you may be converting it into a detention center, but we control the water. And so we aren't going to hook you up to it. And now you have to go back to the drawing board to figure that part out. So there is this tug of war that's happening between state governments, city governments, and the federal government to essentially exert control over what they can to slow this expansion down.
Does that point to a goal of making these facilities kind of self-contained, maybe with things like water or generators right on site, so the federal government can basically do what it wants without giving cities or states any say in what happens there?
Right. And we've heard them say as much here in county council meetings and in their interactions with local lawmakers, essentially speculating that even if they weren't able to hook up to the water, they have enough money under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. You know, again, $38 billion for their detention expansion, but they have enough funding to run them for the next 4 years, that even if they don't hook up to the water, they will just purchase water. But that's all water that has to come in and come out. And so this is my estimation here, it would be advantageous for the Department of Homeland Security to cooperate and try to partner with localities, but they completely eschewed that step. They absolutely went ahead and just did. And now they're trying to figure out the logistics of just water. And I think even within a budget of 40 some million or $40 billion, that's a lot of logistics just to get water on site and off site and sewage off site. And then the question then becomes, where does it go?
Right.
So there are a lot of unknowns there.
All right. That is Mike Wriston, government procurement analyst with Project Saltbox. Mike, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how a kid obsessed with mini golf found his dream job, golf course architecture.
By all accounts, my family said that when I was like 4 and 5 and 6, it was hard to drive past a miniature golf course because I wanted to stop and play.
We'll hear more about the surprising thoughtfulness that goes into creating a fun golf course. But first, data centers are being built all over the valley, often to the objections of the people who live near them. These massive buildings suck up a lot of energy to power AI. But our next guest this morning says they could also be making our already hot city even hotter. David Saylor is the director of ASU School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning. He and his team conducted new research that shows that data centers are warming surrounding neighborhoods by several degrees, mainly through HVAC systems on the roof that keep all that computer equipment inside cool. This is still preliminary research that has yet to be peer reviewed, but it comes as the debate around data centers is only intensifying. I spoke with Saylor more about it, and he told me he's been interested in what makes a city hot for decades, and there are a few different ways that happens.
One of them that has been long known is the effect of anthropogenic waste heat, or simply, you know, the heat that's released associated with energy consumption in cities, whether it's from your vehicles or from your buildings. Mm-hmm. And so we've been studying this facet of the urban climate for decades. And it was only recently when we were doing a study looking at heat mitigation strategies in Phoenix in particular, where we started to put the two together and ask the question, not just how big of an impact does anthropogenic heat have on the warming of the city, but what does that warming look like when we start to talk about some of the most intense energy consumption in the city, which is in these big energy users like data centers.
Right, right. There's a stat here that I was reading about how much energy a data center uses. You know, it takes the space of 20 houses maybe, but uses just exponentially more power, right?
Right, right. So it's a great concentrator of energy consumption, and as a result, a great concentrator of the waste heat emissions.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about how you measured this, because you basically drove a bunch of cars around data centers, right? Measuring the heat as you went and in various zones around it. Describe this for us.
Right. Well, so we've actually looked at about 4 or 5 different data centers in Phoenix. And what we do typically is on any given day, we will instrument typically 3 or 4 cars. We'd like to use electric vehicles if at all possible, because then we don't have to worry about any heat emissions from the vehicle itself, or not very much at least. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we simply try to drive these cars as close to the data centers we can on regular city streets. And we then move in circular motion sort of into the outer neighborhoods surrounding the data center. So we're trying to make measurements both very close to the data centers, but also maybe half to 1 mile to the north, south, east, and west of the data center to see if we can capture a downwind warming effect. And really to identify that downwind effect, we need to make measurements upwind and downwind.
Yeah. So you found some pretty substantial heat impacts, it sounds like, though. Tell us what you found.
Yeah. So it was nothing surprising, really, because, again, we have decades of literature and research on this topic of heat emissions from buildings and cities. And we know that you can elevate the air temperature in the city by several degrees Fahrenheit through the emissions of heat from buildings. And again, data centers are really such concentrated sources of heat that it was not surprising that we found elevated air temperatures 2 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit higher than upwind of the data center. And those elevated air temperatures were several hundred yards into the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, how close do you have to live to a data center to be impacted by it? Should we be looking around to see if you're a couple of miles from one you weren't even aware of, maybe?
Well, that's exactly what the next step in our research is to better understand how that downwind effect spreads and how it varies under different kinds of weather conditions, different kinds of atmospheric stability conditions. And we do, you know, we do expect it to vary quite a bit. And so we need to get a better handle on it, first of all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the short answer is in a city, most of the microclimate variability associated with any major intervention, whether it's a, you know, a cooling intervention like a park or a lake, or whether it's a heating and, you know, an adverse heating source is associated with, say, a data center, mm-hmm. we typically find that those downwind effects are typically limited to hundreds of meters, not multiple miles. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. But more to come there. One of the findings here that it sounds like could be of concern is the nighttime heat impact these data centers could be having.
Yes, absolutely. So what we found in previous research, so this is going back about 20 years now when we were looking at just waste heat emissions in cities, you know, that are typically on the order of maybe 100 watts per square meter of heat emissions for a major U.S. city. And we were finding the largest impacts were both in winter and in summer in the nighttime hours. We haven't really done that systematic approach where we've looked, you know, at multiple hours, day and night. Mm-hmm. We've just taken a few snapshots during the daytime hours. But when we do start to look at the effects in the overnight hours, we certainly do expect to see a larger impact at night than during the day, because for the most part, these data centers are emitting 24/7. So right. They're emitting the same amount of heat for the most part in the evening hours that they do in the daytime.
That's interesting. So are we looking at long-term impacts here? Like, are you, I know this is a lot to be still studied, but are you thinking about things like how a proliferation of these data centers across our city, which is already, you know, the hottest big city in the country and getting hotter, we're already breaking records left and right. Like, are you thinking about how this might add to or make it even harder to live, a more difficult urban heat island impact overall, things like that?
Yeah, certainly that'll be part of what we're looking at into the future. Certainly, as you put more and more of these data centers throughout the city, you'll have more of these pockets of elevated air temperature, more urban heat island, sort of within the urban heat island, if you will. And that will result in elevated air temperatures throughout many of our neighborhoods, which comes with elevated energy consumption to deal with that increased heat, mm-hmm. Elevated water consumption, and of course, elevated risks related to public health.
Yeah. So do you think that cities, local governments, neighborhoods, citizens should be thinking about ways to mitigate that, to balance it even?
Absolutely. That's another aspect of some of the work that we're doing is what can we do in terms of designing data centers to make them have less of an impact downwind in terms of elevating air temperatures in neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so that can include the data center design itself, some of the HVAC equipment parameters in terms of how we design HVAC equipment that go on the data centers, but also maybe just simple things like setbacks, you know, how far a data center has to be from the nearest residential building.
Sure. And just understanding, it sounds like, what it is that we're, you know, building and what it is that AI costs.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Let me leave it there. That is David Saylor, director of ASU School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning, joining us to talk more about this research. David, thank you so much for coming on. This is fascinating stuff.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. The Jewish holiday of Passover begins tonight, and Easter is just around the corner on Sunday. So lots of you, I'm sure, are busy with holiday meal prep. And whether you're a traditionalist looking for bitter herbs and roasted eggs, or you're looking at a light Easter brunch, our next guest says, why not do it Sonoran style? We live here in the Sonoran Desert, which has its own distinct culinary flavor. And Tucson cookbook author and food photographer Jackie Alpers is on the line now to tell us more about her Southwestern take on Easter and Passover meals. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming on. So let's begin with Passover, since it begins tonight. This is a holiday where food's really kind of at the center, right? There's this traditional Seder meal, right? Six symbolic foods that retell the story of the Israelites' exodus from Egypt. What are some Sonoran approaches to this meal?
Well, let's start with the Seder plate. So one of the centers of the Seder plate is the bitter herbs, and arugula, which grows wild in the Sonoran Desert, is a great example of a Sonoran Desert herb that you can use, and also you can use for Easter in a salad.
Mm. I love that. I didn't know arugula grew wild here.
It does.
When I think of this time of year, I think of deviled eggs. That probably goes for both holidays. You have a Chipotle deviled eggs. Tell us about this one.
Well, so I love deviled eggs, and I kind of fancied them up a little bit with some Chipotle, which is definitely Sonoran. And you can add caviar, but just make sure it's not beluga caviar, which is not kosher for Passover. Mm-hmm. And capers for an elegant deviled egg that works perfectly for Passover. Now, with any ingredients for Passover, just make sure you check your ingredients and make sure they are kosher for Passover if that is important to you.
Okay. So, Jackie, you are famous for a recipe that is really cool called albondigas matzo ball soup, right?
kind of a
Sonoran, a Mexican take on this. Tell us about that recipe.
Well, that's one of my favorites. So I love albondigas, but I wanted it to be Sonoran, so I just kind of switched out the albondigas meatballs for matzo balls and kept the whole
<That's awesome.
laughs> and kept thank you and kept the rest of it basically the same. So it's kind of a spicier, more Sonoran version of matzo ball soup, but it definitely has a kind of Sonoran flavored spin with chilies and Mexican oregano that brings it back around to the desert.
The meatballs and matzo balls. I love it. Okay. You have some other matzo kind of based recipes, right? You have tostadas, matzo nachos, things like that. How does that work?
Oh, yeah. So I actually love matzo all year round. And so I had a lot of fun coming up with matzo-based recipes that work for Passover that are also Sonoran. So I've got matzo tostadas, which I made with beans and queso fresco and the traditional kind of Sonoran toppings of radishes and maybe a little bit of peas. That's really great on matzo. It's not really that different from a tostada shell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're crispy, and so it has the same basic vibe. And then matzo nachos, which is just, it's super easy to make. Just crumble up your matzo into the size of like tortilla chips, and then put all of your favorite nacho toppings on and put it under the broiler for a second, and you've got a delicious nachos-ish.
It's awesome-ish, yeah. All right, let's talk about Easter then. I think, traditionally eat lamb on Easter. My memories of the Easter meal are always like this very Midwestern scalloped potato dish. What are some of your ideas here?
Well, I'm not really a big lamb eater, and I know that that's also a center of the Seder plate.
Yep.
But I tend to go more for chicken, and I've got a mole marinade it. It's a mole kind of marinade. It's inspired by mole, but not really mole, that I marinate chicken in and then grill it and serve with chilies and salsa. And like I said, just check your ingredients and make sure they're all kosher, but they should all be, all the ingredients should be fine for Passover. And it brings it around to like a sense of place.
Yeah.
So, you know, like both Easter and Passover are, are important holidays, but in the Sonoran Desert, it's, I think it's always nice to bring them back to a sense of place and where we are here. Yeah.
I read that a traditional kind of Easter dish in Mexico is lamb barbacoa. Have you ever tried that?
No.
Sounds good, right?
It does.
Let's talk about desserts before I let you go, though. What do you make here?
Sure.
I mean, like you think of spring desserts, there's lots of candy involved in Easter, especially. What's on your menu?
Well, I'm making a flourless chocolate cake, which is more of a Passover dish to me. I mean, it goes either way, but you can Sonoranize that by adding a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of red chili, and making it more like a Mexican chocolate flavoring to your traditional kind of flourless chocolate cake.
That sounds very chocolatey, very rich.
It's very yummy.
Yeah. Do you have any Easter basket kind of candy ideas for us? I know you do some melted chocolate candies. You've talked about your popcorn that you make before. It's like a candied popcorn.
That's a fun one. Well, yeah, you know, like I'm actually not a big fan of Peeps, but Peeps can be, but they're really cute. And I think they're really adorable around like to decorate a cake. So you can even do like a store-bought cake and then kind of just put them around the outside. And that's really cute. There's also, I've also got like a recipe that I make for a, like a coconut, nest kind of, cake where you can put the little coconut on top and then put jelly beans on top. And that's adorable.
I love that idea. All right. One thing we have not talked about, Jackie, is probably important here, which is a vegetable. It's important in the Seder meal. Every meal has to have a vegetable. What kind of vegetables do you look at this time of year? It is spring, after all.
Well, yeah. And I think a great, my favorite spring vegetable is asparagus. Mm. And so I dry fry it in just in a hot pan, and it makes it very tender, but still keeps that green to it. And I so that's definitely my kind of go-to vegetable for, and it's super easy. I mean, all you really need is the asparagus, a little bit of balsamic, and some flaky sea salt in a dry pan.
Okay. So have you ever heard of anyone else doing a Sonoran take on these kind of very traditional holidays in this way? What do people say when they hear about this?
No, I haven't. Now, Patty Ginich is Jewish, and she does talk about Mexican Jewish, her influence of being Mexican and Jewish at the same time. And so she is, but not Sonoran. I feel like especially Sonoran cuisine in general is kind of underrepresented overall nationally. People understand Tex-Mex and New Mexico food, but they aren't really familiar with Sonoran style cuisine. And so I do feel like there isn't a lot of Sonoran recipes out there. So if you're looking for more, you can always visit my Substack, which is Sonoran Corner on Substack.
Right.
And so there's a whole bunch there.
Yeah, you've got Sonoran takes on just about everything. But maybe we'll all break some new ground with you here this year. So
that is
Jackie Alpers, the Tucson cookbook author and food photographer, joining us. Thank you so much, Jackie, for coming on. I'm getting hungry.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. The Valley is a famous golf destination, and it's home to some of the most renowned courses in the sport. Now, if you're not a golfer, you might not have thought much about what goes into designing a golf course, and you might think they're all more or less the same size. But as my co-host Sam Dingman recently learned, golf courses are often the product of a very specific vision.
When Forrest Richardson was a little kid, he fell in love with mini golf.
By all accounts, my family said that when I was like 4 and 5 and 6, it was hard to drive past a miniature golf course because I wanted to stop and play. So,
a few years later, his older brother took him to play a round of golf on a regular course, at which point Forrest became, as he puts it, addicted to the game. When he wasn't playing golf, he was sitting with a sketchbook, designing his own courses.
Just fantasy golf holes. And I was creating these, you know, like wild versions of, you know, what I thought a golf course could be. Like, what would be fun, you know, and what if it was really long or really short? Or what if it had palm trees in front of the green or whatever?
At some point, a family friend noticed him doing this and told him he should consider becoming a golf course architect. Forrest was thrilled. He had no idea that was even a job. And he was even more excited when he discovered there was something called the American Society of Golf Course Architects.
I was a pretty entrepreneurial kid. I had letterhead, right? So I sent a letter.
You had letterhead as a kid?
I had letterhead. I don't know what it said, but it made me apparently not look 11 or 12 or whatever.
Forrest got a letter back from the society, which included a directory with contact information of all the golf course architects in North America. There were a handful of them right here in Phoenix, so he cold-called one of them, Arthur Jack Snyder. Jack, as Forrest would come to know him, turned out to be a legend. The day I met Forrest, we were standing on the course that made Jack famous, Mountain Shadows in Paradise Valley.
Way ahead of its time, Mountain Shadows was the fun, not long, 2.5 hour golf experience in 1961, and it had a resort and restaurants and little golf course, called back then an executive course.
The idea behind the so-called executive course, also known as a short course, was that you, a busy executive, could play a full round of golf, 18 holes, in about half the time it would normally take. Instead of a sprawling 7,000-yard expanse of grass and sand, Mountain Shadows is condensed into just a few thousand yards, all of it contained in a quiet neighborhood in the Camelback foothills. The holes are, well, short, about 70 yards or so. Each one is a little puzzle, kind of like mini golf. Case in point, the 12th hole, or as Forrest calls it, the oasis.
This little pond was Jack's little oasis in the desert.
Wow.
And I don't know what kind of birds are out there today, but you can hear them in the palm trees there.
As we approached the pond, a heron took off from the shore and glided across the water. Meanwhile, two golfers teed off from the opposite side of the pond. I watched them try to figure out the puzzle. In order to reach the hole, they had to chip the ball over the water towards a small hill. If they hit it too hard, the ball would roll up the hill, and they'd have to somehow putt it downhill without it rolling into the pond. But if they chipped it too softly, it wouldn't make it over the pond. The key, Forrest explained, is to hit the ball just hard enough to land on the slope of the hill, so it rolls down gently towards the hole. We watched one of the golfers take a swing.
Oh, there's a good shot. Look at that. Now this one's going to back. Oh, come back!
And here she's, say, she's fishing here, her ball out of the water as we speak.
She's fishing her ball out of the water. The good news is the little rocks on the shoreline stopped it from going too far down. But, you know, they're going to give her a hard time. They're going to say, well, you know, you should have just hit an easy shot. You know, you shouldn't have gone for all the glory. You know, what looked like a pretty simple little hole just... It was a train wreck here. not that that's what I wanted to set out to do, but, you know, it's meant to make you think.
The current version of Mountain Shadows is actually a reboot of Jack Snyder's original design. Snyder passed away in 2005, and a few years ago, when it came time to redesign Mountain Shadows, they called Forrest. It was a special moment for him. He considered Jack his mentor. They had worked together for years before he died.
What do you feel like you got from him that you carry with you the most?
I think I took with me the Snyder values of people come first.
In a practical sense, that means designing holes that pack interesting golf into small spaces that are thrilling for players at any skill level. The Oasis, that 12th hole, is only about 75 yards. You don't have to start by swinging a driver and trying to whack the ball 300 yards over a tree line. Ideally, anyone can play a short course.
You know, I can come out here and play with one of my, let's say,
great nephews or nieces might be 10 years old, 12 years old, whatever, and length is not the defining factor, right? So, you know, dad can come out here with his daughter, and on a short course, they can both reach the green in the same number of shots, one, and maybe the daughter's even a better putter than dad, right? So mm-hmm. It's not about length and having to hit the ball a long way. So it's very, very fun.
But that doesn't mean it's easy.
You know, we want the golf holes to make people think and to solve the puzzle.
Make no mistake, Mountain Shadows is not some rookie course. Golfers come from all over the country to play it, and they pay top dollar. A round at Mountain Shadows costs more than some full-size courses.
You know, it's amazing, right, that they're willing. It's kind of like the beer analogy. Golf was, for many, many decades, only selling a keg of beer. Now people are willing to buy, you know, the little craft beers, and they'll pay premium for it. And that's kind of the same thing we've seen in golf.
But on the other hand, I associate golf culture with, well, executives, corporate types. Not exactly the kind of people who are generally interested in pushing boundaries. I asked Forrest if there's any resistance to short courses in the conservative corners of the golf world. He said it happens, but not as much as it used to. When architects first started designing short courses, they sort of felt like an afterthought. The architects weren't putting as much effort into them as Forrest and Jack did with Mountain Shadows.
I'm not taking credit for the short course movement, but I was certainly part of it, trying to get people to think, not only golf architects, but developers and people that invest in courses and resort developers and community developers, to get them to think about golf isn't just one size.
Forrest likes to point out that one of the most hallowed golf courses in the world, Leith Links in Scotland, only has 5 holes. And that short courses also use less water, take up less space, and create jobs. But of course, Forrest also admits that the people who really love short courses are people like him, the golf architects.
When I create a design, I'm able to say, golfer, stand here and execute a shot to that target. The golf architect is able to, on paper, plan and in the field create a place where we say, this is where you'll start and this is where you'll end. It's really defined by the golf architect.
Well, Forrest, this has been absolutely fascinating.
You got to see almost half the shots on number 12 go in the water,
yeah.
Which is depressing in a way. But I will say that we've also seen some good shots.
And everybody who's driven by us on a golf cart afterwards has been smiling very broadly.
I've noticed that.
The Maricopa County Fair opens at the State Fairgrounds on Friday, featuring the usual complement of fried foods, scary rides, and skee ball. But this year, a couple of popular attractions will be missing. Karen Searle, director of the Maricopa County Fair, confirmed to us earlier this week that the fair is skipping both the petting zoo and pony rides this time around. This follows cases of E. coli that were traced last fall to the petting zoo at the Arizona State Fair. Out of a, quote, abundance of caution and because of public concern, there will be plenty of livestock exhibits and displays this year, but no, quote, direct public animal contact, according to Searle. Along with hand-washing stations, fair officials are putting up barriers around animal exhibits and posting signs asking patrons to refrain from touching any animals. The Maricopa County Fair runs from April 3rd to the 12th. And that'll do it for this edition of the show. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radioheads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. And Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.